The following presentation was recorded live, February 14th through the 17th, at the McHenry Convention Center in San Jose, California, for RSA Conference 2006. We take you live, where our session is just getting underway.
Good afternoon. Welcome to our mock trial, challenging a digitally signed legal document in court. This is the first part. Just a couple of housekeeping notes, if you'll bear with me for a second. I just want to remind everyone to please turn off your cell phones and PDAs. Please complete the session evaluations. Your ratings and comments are important input to our continued efforts on improving the conference. The evaluation forms are directly in the back on the table. You can reach them there. All education sessions are recorded. Copies of the recordings on CD and MP3 can be purchased in the CD MP3 sales booth located on the concourse level, Marriott End. Don't forget your RSA conference memorabilia, maybe some late Valentine's Day presents, such as pens, notebooks, apparel, and other fun stuff at the Marketplace, which is located on the concourse level. Marketplace is open today and tomorrow from 9 to 6 p.m. Tonight is also the RSA Conference 2006 15th Anniversary Gala from 7 to 11 p.m., located in the South Hall, directly behind the Convention Center. The only entrance is on the Market Street, just as if you were coming into the Marriott entrance. One last reminder for attorneys in the room. Please note the following if you're interested in CLE credit. The back of the room on the left-hand side of the table are forms that must be completed in order to receive CLE credit. All attorneys seeking CLE credit must sign in on the pink sign-in sheet. There's also a blue certificate of attendance to take with you, and if you need instructions, they're on the white sheet. We also have been told that the ABA will mail a certificate of attendance to each attendee who signs in on the pink sheet. There are separate sign-in sheets if you are licensed in New York, Delaware, Texas, or Pennsylvania. Note that any attorneys from New York or Delaware must sign in and out of each session on the form that session for that session in order to receive CLE credit. I'd like to introduce today our moderator, Stephen Wu, partner, Cook, Kobrick, and Wu LLP. Stephen's the CEO of InfoSec Law Group, PC, and the consulting firm InfoAlliance Incorporated. Stephen advises clients on legal, business, and technical information security matters. He is a past co-chair of the American Bar Association's Information Security Committee, 1988 graduate of Harvard Law School, and formerly led VeriSign's worldwide policies for its digital certification services. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you very much.
And a partner of Cook, Kobrick, Cook,
she did mention that.
Kobrick, and Wu.
Yeah, and actually I'm going to cut short the introduction so that we can save some time for what we hope to be a very enjoyable and educational mock trial challenging a digitally signed legal document in court. To my right is David Isom, who's a shareholder in the international firm Greenberg Traurig LLP. To his right is Hoyt Kesterson II, who's a consultant with Badham Meekham. Charles Merrill, who's up on the stage here, is counsel with McCarter & English LLP. And to my left is Ann Rogers, Director, Information Safeguards, Waste Management Incorporated. This mock trial is actually broken out into two sessions. During this portion of the session, we will be trying to put on the trial portion itself with some argument. And in the next session, we will have the judge's rulings on the arguments and the fact-finding leading up to the penultimate conclusion. So if you want to hear the answer after all is said and done, you got to come to the next session. Now, I would say there a couple disclaimers. One is that because we have so little time, we're skipping portions of what you might see in a real trial. So, for example, the questioning is going to be more superficial than you might otherwise see in a real court case. Also, we're going to skip steps like swearing in witnesses. And so we're just going to pick and choose little vignettes of what you might see in a trial rather than trying to show you something that's entirely accurate. Also, on behalf of our expert, Hoyt, I just want to say, by way of disclaimer, that anything that Hoyt says during this conference may or may not reflect his real opinions as a technical expert. So let's talk about the mock trial that we are going to present here. There are facts to this hypothetical case that I passed around. If you've just walked into the room, you may not have gotten that. Hopefully you'll be able to pass around the facts and refer to them. There's a sheet that's floating around. If there's anybody with packets left over, if you wouldn't mind putting them on the back table so that folks who are coming in late can get their a packet to see what the facts are and refer to it. Let's talk about our cast of characters today. You've got some rich folks here, Richie Rich and Fairly Rich, pronounced Fairly Rich. They have two children, Riley Rich, as in he's Riley, Riley Rich, and Agne. Now think about Pig Latin when you hear the word Agne. As rich folks are wont to do, I should also mention, you're going to hear in the story part a couple of certification authorities. The law firm that Ritchie and Fairley use for their estate planning is a certification authority. It outsources its back-end functions to Big Cert Corporation. And you're going to hear about Rich LLC, which is the Rich family business, about 50 employees. They have their own CA for their employees to get certificates for vendor and customer transactions. So here is the sequence of events. I'm just going to flesh this out a little bit, but I'm going to leave this up on the screen during the trial so that you can see the timing of things. These are rich folks, and they plan their estate. So they have their lawyers draft up in paper a revocable living trust called the Rich Family Trust, and they sign it on paper. What it says is that when both spouses are dead, Riley and Agne, the two kids, split whatever is left over evenly. That means everything, except as it pertains to antique china. Antique china and jewelry all goes to Agne, and all golf-related tangible property goes to Riley. So you'll hear Richie and Riley are really golf nuts. Richie and Fairley are brilliant inventors. They have invented some really super fantastic code. They store that code in the repository of Steel Summit Incorporated. The idea is that this is their crown jewels. They license that software to their company, Rich LLC, and then Rich LLC turns around and makes a whole lot of money by exploiting that code. Richie and Fairley are both officers in the company. The Steel Summit online repository is accessible only through the web by use of a token, which is a USB token, allows the user to authenticate him or herself to the website. There is a privacy policy that Steel Summit has and an online contract which prohibits Steel Summit from simply giving out this information to anybody who would want to ask for it. You need the token in order to get at the information on Steel Summit. As it turns out, as I said, Richie's a golf nut, so what he does is he puts his token into a knickknack of his in the shape of his favorite golf bag. In 2002, following some changes in the tax law, Richie and Fairley go back to their lawyers. They sign a trust amendment, a first trust amendment. This document is for the purpose of saving themselves on taxes, but again, it says things are split evenly to the kids other than the jewelry, the china, and the golf-related paraphernalia. So it has nothing to do with who gets what. It's just a tax change. The CA, that's the law firm, issues a certificate to each of Richie and Fairley so that they can sign their first trust amendment. In November 2004, Richie and Fairley become victims of a heinous car accident, and Fairley dies after that accident. Very unfortunate. Agne takes care of the badly ailing Richie for the next year, attempting to nurse him back to health. Riley is unfortunately too busy playing golf to help out with Richie's care. After about a year, Agne feels, gee, I'm really owed something more than what I have in the trust, and starts nagging Richie to change the Rich Family Trust to leave her more. Richie dies in January 2006. After Richie's death, Agne comes up with a document and says, oh, on December 31st, 2005, a document dated December 31st, 2005 is a second trust amendment. This trust amendment leaves the Crown Jewels code to me. And she hires a lawyer who files an action to say to the court, please give us instructions to confirm that actually the second trust amendment makes me the trustee, so I'm in charge of everything, and I'm entitled to this code. The second amendment appears to be digitally signed by Richie's private key, whose corresponding public key appears in a certificate that she shows to everybody, issued by Rich LLC for use in company transactions with its vendors and customers. The certificate is dated 1 week before the date of the second trust amendment, December 24th, 2005. The certificate was issued by certificate software, a cert server, and it was at the Rich LLC facility. The Rich LLC HR admin has the registration authority administrator privileges, so she is the one who can approve certificate applications, although Agne is the administrator's boss and is in charge of all IT functions at Rich LLC. So now we have an action pending in the Santa Clara County Superior Court Probate Division to confirm that Agne Rich is the trustee and that she's entitled to the code. Riley Rich is opposing this action and challenges the second trust amendment claiming it's fraudulent. He also wants the USB token saying it's golf-related and therefore his. Steel Summit appears in the case and does not want to disclose any code, saying that the user agreement and privacy policy doesn't permit the company to just simply give it out. So we have before us a fact-finding hearing concerning who owns this property and who is whether the Second Trust Amendment is a valid document, a validly digitally signed document or not. And we also will have an evidentiary hearing as part of this. So our agenda today, let's go to the cast of characters. The probate judge is Charles Merrill. David Isom is counsel for Agnew Rich. I am counsel for Riley Rich. Hoyt Kesterson will be an expert who is going to be called as a witness by called by Agnew Rich's counsel. And Ann Rogers is appearing today as counsel for Steel Summit. So very shortly, I will be calling the court to order, so I hope you can all cooperate with the instructions of the court. We will be having some opening legal argument that you will be hearing about shortly. Then a mock examination. This is just a very small part of the trial, but the critical part of this trial will relate to the examination of Mr. Kesterson as an expert for Agnew Rich. Then we will have a legal argument concerning what does Steel Summit really have to do? What is its obligations relative to this court case? Does it have to disclose the information? We'll have some closing arguments. And then, as I say, you're going to have to wait to the next session to hear the court's rulings, which will be in the next session. In the next session, we'll also have some postmortem and questions and answers, so you can ask all the questions you want. Here's our contact information. So I'm going to put up the facts again so that you can refer to them during our presentation. We can now bring up the lights in the room, and I'm going to call the case to order. All rise. Hear ye, hear ye. This session of the Superior Court of California, County of Santa Clara, Probate Division is now in session. The Honorable Charles R. Merrill presiding.
You may be seated.
Counselors, may we have your opening, may we have your appearance, please?
Your Honor, let me introduce my client, Agnew Rich, and I'm David Isom representing Agnew Rich.
Stephen Wu appearing for Riley Rich. Mr. Rich.
Your Honor, I'm Ann Rogers, and I'm representing Steel Summit.
Opening statements from you, Mr. Isom.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, this is a case about the difference between speculation and fact. In this opening statement, I want to talk about what the facts are that will be presented to the court. And I just would like to distinguish that from speculation. We'll be hearing a lot of speculation today. But the facts are as follows, essentially. First, Richie Rich was a sophisticated, technical, brilliant person, as was his wife. And in 1998, they created a revocable living trust. In 2002, they amended that trust and created it electronically. One of the things that we'll see over and over again today is that everything they intended relating to the electronics, the technology, the process, the protocol of this electronic living trust is exactly what has happened in this case. There will be evidence that there were two amendments to this trust. The first in 2002, when the trust was amended, it was made electronic at that time.
The previous one was paper-based?
Yes, the previous one was paper. And let me just summarize the important parts of the electronic features. They established a careful, secure protocol so that if the trust were to be amended, there would be an established protocol to determine how it could be amended and how it could be shown that the amendment were by the people who were authorized. They provided that the revocable living trust would be signed electronically by the use of Mr. Rich's key or Mrs. Rich's key. And as your honors knows, in 2004, there was a terrible accident and Mrs. Rich was killed. Thereafter, there was a second amendment, and all the facts in this case will show that the second amendment was effected by Mr. Rich through the use of his private key. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Isom. Mr. Wu.
Your Honor, this is a case concerning a second trust amendment that followed a first trust amendment that followed a paper revocable living trust. We find that the paper trust is very clear, validly written. First trust amendment. This is a document that was signed in a law firm by a very secure process by which a credential was issued to the Riches. They signed the document. All things in order. The second trust amendment, however, was a document that was signed 1 week after a credential was issued that permitted the signature to be verified, and very shortly before Mr. Rich's death. Ms. Rich discovers this document after the death and brings it to the court's attention. The second trust amendment, however, changes the way that the property is left from being split equally between Mr. Riley Rich and Ms. Agnew Rich. All of a sudden, the second trust amendment says that Ms. Agnew Rich is entitled to the Crown Jewel software held by Steel Summit. It is true that a digital signature appears on the second trust amendment just as it does on the first trust amendment. But what the evidence will show is that these digital signatures are, in fact, very different. They are different because the processes that underlie the ways in which these credentials were issued are very different. And, in fact, the evidence will show that the process by which the credential issued by Rich LLC to purporting to be to Mr. Rich is, in fact, extremely insecure. Is insecure because it is possible that Ms. Rich, who was in charge of information systems at Rich LLC, had the opportunity and the ability to issue a credential to herself in the name of Mr. Richie Rich and sign the second trust amendment without any ability for anybody to detect otherwise. The credential was, in fact, so insecure that we have absolutely no assurance that the digital signature on the second trust amendment is in fact the digital signature of Mr. Richie Rich. The sequence of events in which credential is issued, a week later a second trust amendment is issued, and then the death occurs, leads us to believe that the circumstantial evidence is that this quite possibly could have been a fraudulent signature. In fact, it may even be possible, the evidence will show, that the signature was created, that the credential was issued and the signature created after the death of Mr. Richie Rich. In short, Ms. Agnew Rich had the means, the motive, and the opportunity to forge the signature of Richie Rich. And in any case, the evidence will show that Agnew Rich has not borne her burden of proof to prove that the second trust amendment is valid, and the court should ignore the second trust amendment and find that the property should be divided in accordance with the paper trust, or alternatively, the first trust amendment. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Wu. I understand the dispute between Agnew Rich and Riley Rich, but Mrs. Rogers, why are you intervening in this proceeding on behalf of Steel Summit?
Your Honor, I'm here with Steel Summit because we have also been contacted by the parties in this case. And in fact, we have a petition before your court asking the court to force Steel Summit to release the contents of the account that belonged to Richie Rich and Fairly Rich. We object to that, Your Honor. We feel that that is a violation of the privacy laws and the contractual obligation we had with the correct owners of this account. And that's why we're here to object.
All right. Mrs. Rogers, I think we will probably address most of the dispute between the other parties first. And toward the end of the proceeding, why don't we see where we are, and then we'll return to your intervention.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At this point, we are cutting the proceedings short. I'm just going to give you a little bit of glimpse into what you would have seen had we had a full trial. Each side gets to present a case in chief. Mr. Isom would have called his own witnesses, and we're not going to go through this testimony for lack of time, but he would have called Agnes Rich, and she would have said that Richie had told her before he died that he created a second trust amendment, that he made these changes to give her the crown jewel code out of gratitude for all the care that she had given him during the past year. He then told her where to find the trust amendment, so when he unfortunately did pass away, she simply brought the document to the attention of her attorney, who in turn brought this petition to make sure that she had the property that she is entitled to under the second trust amendment. She would have said during that testimony that she had absolutely nothing to do with the creation of that second trust amendment and absolutely nothing to do with the digital signature that was applied to that second amendment. Mr. Isom also would have called the law firm managing partner, the estate planning lawyer, and the paralegal, who were all involved in the process by which the first trust amendment was signed. They would have testified to the procedures by which certificates were issued by the law firm and how both Mr. and Mrs. Rich signed their documents, signed the First Amendment to the trust, and how the process really worked. So now we are at a part of the case where before Mr. Isom is about to call his last witness, Judge Merrill has decided to hear an argument from counsel concerning actually a legal basis for excluding the trust amendments. I will be arguing that the amendments should be excluded as a matter of California law because of the very fact that they are electronic. The judge can hold these sidebar conferences to hear matters of whether evidence should go in or outside, separate and apart from the trial proceedings. So we're having a little sideshow here.
Mr. Wu, I understand you have a motion to the effect that the First and Second Amendment should not be admitted by reason of the California Civil Code equivalent of the Uniform Electronic Transactions Act. Would you please state your motion?
Yes, Your Honor. It is our position that the court should ignore the First and Second Trust Amendment because they are electronic, strictly because they are in electronic form. The sole law in California to enable electronic signatures and records that would allow the court to admit these documents in evidence and give them force is the California version of the Uniform Electronic Transactions Act. Section 1633.7 of the Civil Code says, a record or signature may not be denied legal effect or enforceability solely because it is in electronic form. Section 1633.13 says, in a proceeding, evidence of a record or signature may not be excluded solely because it is in electronic form. Now, Your Honor, if those were the only two statutes as part of the Uniform Electronic Transactions Act, which I call UETA, that would be the end of the story, and these trust amendments could be admitted by the court. However, that is not the case. There is an exception in Section 1633.3 that says this title, meaning UETA, does not apply to transactions subject to the following laws. And subsection B1 says, a law governing the creation and execution of wills, codicils, or testamentary trusts. That is a will, an amendment to a will, or a trust created by a will. Your Honor, in this case, we have a revocable living trust and two electronic trust amendments. This trust was used as a substitute for a will. That is, it divides the property of the Riches just as effectively as a will could. Therefore, this document, this trust amendment, and the purported second trust amendment are, in fact, will substitute documents. They are tantamount to a will. Therefore, Your Honor, an exception, the exception concerning wills that I just read you, should be construed to apply in this case. In fact, in Ike versus Doolittle in the 4th Appellate District, the court said that in 1986, the legislature revised the probate code of California, and the proposed trust law reorganized existing law, but attempted insofar as possible to eliminate distinctions between living trusts, that is a trust created during the lifetime of the people who created the trust, and testamentary trusts. The word in UETA exception is testamentary trust. You should read that together. You should read that to mean that it extends to living trusts and exclude the applicability of UETA. Therefore, there is no law to support the validity of the electronic amendments, and I ask that you exclude the electronic trust amendments from evidence.
Did the Ike versus Doolittle case recognize that the living trust does not require passes through probate upon death, that it goes automatically into the terms of the trust? Seems to me, if I look at the list of the items excluded, the ones excluded are all those that require the assistance of this probate division or the probate officers of this court.
That is what the exception states, Your Honor, but the case of Ike versus Doolittle says that the distinctions between testamentary trust and living trust are to be eliminated.
Thank you, Mr. Wu. Mr. Isom?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. As Your Honor knows, one of the principal rules of statutory construction is that if there's any ambiguity, that ambiguity should be resolved in favor of supporting the general purpose of a statute. The general purpose of this statute clearly is to bring the law into this new millennium. Section 7 of UEDA says, a record or signature may not be denied legal effect or enforceability solely because it is an electronic form. In essence, this is saying the law should not discriminate against electronic documents. They should be given the same effect as paper documents have been given for so many centuries. Second, UEDA says, if a law requires a record to be in writing, an electronic record satisfies the law. And third, it says, if a law requires a signature, an electronic signature satisfies the law. Thus, the law and policy of California is that courts should not discriminate against electronic commerce, electronic media, but should enforce the agreements reflected in those media the same as if they were in paper. Riley's only argument is that a living revocable trust somehow should be construed to be a, quote, will, codicil, or testamentary trust. We have two arguments, Your Honor. First, the well-known maximum expressio unius says that when some exceptions to a general rule are listed, the general rule will apply unless those specific exceptions are listed. Here, there is no living revocable trust listed. Secondly, as Your Honor pointed out earlier, the difference is these exceptions relate to instruments that pass at death. There must have been some sense that if something is happening after the death of a person, these laws wouldn't apply. The difference here is a revocable living trust, remember, is living. It effects a transfer of property during the life of the person and is revocable. In other words, it's alive while the people are still alive. Your Honor, it simply is not a will, codicil, or testamentary trust, and UEDA should apply to give effect to an electronic living trust.
Thank you, Mr. Isom. Do you have anything further, Mr. Wu? I've read the briefs prior to this motion, and I've considered it, and I'm persuaded by Mr. Isom's argument that if the legislature had intended to accept this kind of document too, notwithstanding its differences, doesn't pass through probate with the other, it would have said so in the exception. So I'm going to deny the motion and allow both the First and Second Amendments in as against any bar of electronicness pursuant to UEDA. If we had not allowed them in under UEDA, they really would not have satisfied the statute of wills and the other laws governing dispositive instruments. So I'm going to deny the motion and allow them in. Do you have any objection in view of the other disputes coming, Mr. Wu? Do you have any objection to the admission of Trust Amendment Number 1? Is that important to you?
Subject to my continuing objection based on the electronic nature of this document, I have no other objection.
Thank you, Mr. Wu. Mr. Isom, do you have any witnesses?
Yes, Your Honor. We'd like to call Hoyt Kesterson as an expert witness in this case.
Remember, you're sworn, Hoyt. Mr. Kesterson.
I am back.
Mr. Kesterson, the judge has told us that he's so impressed with your credentials that you won't need to recite them.
Thank you.
Would you explain to His Honor what a digital signature is?
Yes. A digital signature is a mechanism that is provided by essentially the art of cryptography, and it is a special form of that cryptography. A digital signature requires a unique pair of values, two values, which are uniquely associated with each other. One of these values is kept secret. It is referred to as the private key. And one of these values is made public. It is considered the public key. And the relationship of these values is one of its unique natures is that knowing the public key gives you no knowledge of knowing the private key. Then the private key is used in an operation, a mathematical manipulation of the data that you wish to sign. In reality, what you do is you will take that data and you will reduce it to a unique form called a hash of that data. And then the second value, the private key value, will be used in a cryptographic algorithm to essentially encrypt that hash. Then that encrypted hash can only be verified by the uniquely associated public key value. In other words, no other public key value will in fact indicate that the uniquely associated second value, the private key value, was in fact used to do it. And it is because of this unique bonding, this pairing, that we can basically say that if you can validate an encryption with the public key value, then you know it must have been signed with or encrypted with the private key value. And it is this application to the hash which is considered to be a digital signature. That leaves only one other problem. This, of course, is a mathematical binding of two values. What does that mean in terms of an individual? And so what happens, an authority, which we call the certification authority, will take the public key and will securely bind it to the identity of the owner of the public key and also, therefore, the owner of the associated private key. It's interesting that this binding itself is protected with a digital signature, and the authority has available its public key. So the process of verification is to take the certificate and first verify that it is in fact the certificate of the individual whose signature you are attempting to validate, to then take that certificate and to verify by the public key of the certification authority that it is a legitimate certificate that has been signed by the certification authority, and therefore we know is an examined binding. The certification authority is stating that this is the public key of citizen John Q. Smith.
If a person has the public key only, can that person decrypt a message?
Well, they can verify the signature. The decryption is not really the quite thing here, but they can only verify the message. They themselves cannot pretend to be the person and use that value to do a digital signature. Now, then after I now know that this is the public key of, say, for example, John Smith, I can now use that public key to examine the purported digitally signed document supposedly signed by John Smith. And if, in fact, that public key verifies that signature, in other words, applying the algorithm and you get the right answer, you know two things. You know that it was signed by the private key associated with the public key that you're using and by the statement of the certification authority, therefore, is the private key of John Smith, and only John Smith could have applied it. And at the same time, you also know that this document could not have been changed because any change of this document would have changed the hash, the value to which the encryption has been applied. And therefore, we know two things. This is the document unchanged as it was digitally signed by John Smith.
Mr. Eisen, my head is spinning. Are you going to connect this up with the facts in this
case?
Yes,
I am, Your Honor. Let me ask some questions. Of course, all of us understand this.
Well, please proceed, but our patience is limited.
Mr. Kesterson, let me ask some specific questions. We're not talking about John Smith here. We're talking about Richie Rich. Did you investigate the facts here as they relate to the First Amendment and Richie Rich?
Yes. And what has happened is that the First Amendment, which was published by a law firm, which was essentially constructed by a law firm that was contracted by Mr. Rich, has an ability to issue these certificates, these digital signature certificates that I just announced. And so what they did is they essentially generated two pairs of unique values. One pair of unique values went to Mr. Rich, one pair went to Mrs. Rich. And of those two pairs of values, one value was kept secret by Mr. Rich, only he knew it, not even Mrs. Rich. And the other one was just the same, only Mrs. Rich knew it, not Mr. Rich. And, of course, the law firm didn't know it.
Were those used to sign the First Amendment?
Yes, they were actually used to sign the First Amendment, and I can validate this because the law firm contracts with a very sophisticated certification authority, which produced a certificate, one for Mr. Richie Smith and the other one for Mrs. Farley Smith. And so, essentially, I have validated that those certificates are, in fact, correct. I have examined the public keys of the certification authority to determine those certificates are as they were issued. Therefore, the public keys contained within are the public keys of Mr. and Mrs. Rich, respectively. I have, in fact, then taken those public keys to verify the two digital signatures that were applied to the First Amendment, and therefore I can state that those documents were, in fact, digitally signed by Mr. and Mrs. Rich, and that those documents and that that trust has not changed since that signature was applied.
And Mr. Kesterson, did you perform a similar investigation as it relates to the Second Amendment?
Yes, I did. Mr. Rich owns his own company. That company has a certification authority. Mr. Rich had a certificate essentially prepared for him with, again, another pair of values, one of which he kept private. Mr. Rich used that private key to essentially digitally sign an amendment that he produced. I looked at that associated certificate. It was, in fact, and used the public key of the certification authority to validate that that certificate was, in fact, correct and had not been changed. I used the public key that was contained in that certificate to essentially apply it against the Second Amendment, and I can state that, based on the technology, that is the digital signature of Mr. Rich.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Wu, do you have cross-examination?
I believe, Your Honor, that we have a procedural matter concerning the admission of the First and Second.
Do you have an offer, Mr. Eisen?
Yes, Your Honor. The First Amendment has already been admitted, and for the same reasons that the First Amendment was admitted, we move the admission of the Second Amendment.
All right. I believe there's a continuing objection on the First Amendment as well, based solely on the UEJA grounds, but the digital signature issue is the only. Well, we have other objections, I believe, about to be stated by Mr. Wu.
Your Honor, I do indeed object to both trust amendments. My objection to the first trust amendment is based on the fact that it is electronic, and my continuing objection to the ruling concerning its admission. But other than that, I have no objection to the first trust amendment. Your Honor, however, I do object to the second trust amendment based on lack of foundation. We believe that the evidence presented by Mr. Eisen on behalf of Ms. Rich is not sufficient to show the adequateness of the security underlying the signature on the second trust amendment, and therefore the record is insufficient to show that the document is what Ms. Rich purports it to be, which is a second trust amendment signed by Mr. Rich.
Do I understand you then to be claiming that this second amendment lacks insufficient foundation to be admitted into evidence in this proceeding?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Would you like to state your do you have any cross-examination in support of that?
If Your Honor rules against me on this objection, then yes, I will have cross-examination.
I believe we will hold the ruling until you have your cross-examination, Mr. Kesterson, if that's acceptable to you, Mr. Wu.
Very well, Your Honor. Mr. Kesterson, I'm going to ask you some questions not about the digital signature technology, but about the business processes that underlie how the credentials to verify the signatures were issued. I'd like to take you through some of the factors that you investigated when you looked at the law firm CA infrastructure, certification authority infrastructure, credential issuing infrastructure, and the Rich LLC infrastructure by which these credentials and digital certificates were issued. So I'm going to be comparing and contrasting these. We're asking you some questions to compare and contrast these. Let's begin with the law firm case. The law firm uses Big Cert Corporation as a managed public key infrastructure service, does it not?
Yes, it does.
And the law firm approves certificate applications, correct?
That's correct.
Those certificates are issued to clients so that they can sign legal documents. Isn't that true?
That's correct.
And in fact, the certificates issued by Big Cert have the law firm name as certification authority, correct?
That is correct.
Now, the Big Cert Corporation has a secure data facility, doesn't it?
That is so.
Now, let's compare this to the Rich LLC certification authority. The company issues, the company Rich LLC issues its own certificate. Isn't that true?
That's correct. It has its own CA.
And it's true, is it not, that the certificates are issued by a certificate server software on a server at the Rich LLC offices, correct?
That is correct.
And it's correct, is it not, sir, that that certificate service is, in fact, in a closet, isn't it?
Well, it's a very small room.
And that room at one time had been a closet, wasn't it?
That may well have been. I saw no brooms.
Well, we'll just have to sweep that clean.
Please, please.
Now, the Rich LLC certificates are issued in the company's name, correct?
That is correct.
Let's talk about the registration or enrollment for certificates. In the law firm case, the law firm approves certificate applications, doesn't it?
That's correct.
And in fact, it's a paralegal within the law firm who acts as an administrator to approve or deny certificate applications, correct?
Yes.
And in the case of Rich LLC, there is a registration authority, someone who approves certificate applications, correct?
Yes.
And that person who approves or denies certificate applications is an HR administrator, correct?
That's correct.
Let's talk about the trust, the trusted roles that are involved in issuance of certificates. At the Big Cert Data Center, it's true, is it not, that the personnel there use what is called a separation of duties in operating their facility, correct?
Yes.
And that means that not one person can effectuate the issuance of a certificate without the cooperation of other folks, or at least to allow the certification authority to be online and issue certificates. True?
That's correct.
And at the law firm, it's true, is it not, that the RA administrator, the paralegal, has what you would consider a trusted role?
That's correct.
And the firm's administrator partner has oversight over that paralegal, right?
Yes.
And, in fact, that administrative partner could revoke the paralegal's authority as registration authority administrator, true?
Yes.
But it's true, is it not, that that administrative partner has no ability to issue or approve a certificate application himself, correct?
That's correct.
Now let's contrast the situation with Rich LLC. At Rich LLC, the HR administrator approves certificate applications. Isn't that what you testified?
Yes, I did.
And it's true, is it not, that that HR administrator reports to Ms. Agnay Rich, correct?
Everyone reports to Ms. Agnay Rich.
And she is a person who is in charge of all information systems functions at Rich LLC, correct?
That is correct.
And in fact, she has super user privileges, true?
Yes, she is the administrator.
So she heads all of the information systems functions at Rich LLC, right?
She is responsible for them, yes.
And that means that she has the ability to use her password to gain access to any computer within Rich LLC, true?
Yes, she could do that.
Let's talk about the certificates in question. The certificate issued by the law firm is meant for clients to sign legal documents, right?
That's correct.
Now let's compare this to the Rich LLC case. The certificates issued by Rich LLC were for the business of Rich LLC, right?
That's correct.
These certificates could be used, for example, for transactions with vendors or customers, right?
That's correct.
And it's true, is it not, that Rich LLC is not in the business of estate planning?
That's correct.
Let's talk about the process by which the Riches receive their certificates at the law firm. The keys that you mentioned during your direct examination are generated on a token, correct?
That's correct.
And this is a device that protects these keys from being compromised, correct?
Yes, they can't be read.
And these tokens were placed, the token was connected to a workstation at the law firm to make the signature, correct?
That's correct.
And the certificate application at the law firm was submitted to the paralegal, correct?
As has been stated, yes.
And the paralegal then would go to his or her workstation to approve that certificate application, right?
That's correct.
Let's talk about the enrollment for a certificate at Rich LLC. It's your understanding, is it not, that an employee...
Excuse me, could you explain the meaning of the importance of the token to hold the certificates? What are you driving at, please?
Yes, Mr. Kesterson. We had earlier stated, the token protects the private key from being stolen or corrupted, right?
The private key value is very large, not easily memorized, and therefore it must be typically stored in some media. A token is a chosen media that is very portable, allowing the person to control access to it.
Does it stay in the PC?
No, it would only be there at the time the person needs to make a digital signature.
I see. Thank you.
But in the case of Rich LLC, the employees who create keys store their keys simply on the hard drives of their laptops, right?
That's correct. No token systems.
In the enrollment process at Rich LLC, if an employee were to seek to apply for a certificate, that employee would go to the company intranet. Isn't that true?
That's correct.
And it's true, is it not, that the HR administrator would then sign on to his or her workstation and approve the certificate application or deny it, right?
That's correct.
And after an approval, a certificate would be issued by the certificate server of Rich LLC, correct?
That's correct.
Let's talk about the approval of the certificate application. At the law firm level, the RA would log on, the paralegal would log on to her workstation, right?
That's correct.
And then she would log on to the registration authority application that permits her to approve or deny certificate applications, right?
That's correct.
And the administrative partner would not be able to log on to the RA system, right?
That's correct.
Now let's contrast this with the Rich LLC case. The HR administrator would log on to the HR workstation, right?
That's correct.
And the HR administrator would put in a password to gain access to the RA functions on the RA application on that workstation, right?
That's correct.
And it's correct, is it not, that at that point the HR administrator could approve or deny certificate applications?
That's correct.
Now, isn't it true that Ms. Agne-Rich could also have logged on to the HR administrator's computer?
Ms. Agne-Rich is the administrator and therefore can look at any system.
So I take that's a yes, right?
You can take that as a yes, yes.
And in fact, Ms. Agne-Rich could then have logged on to the RA system to approve or deny certificate applications, correct?
Yes, that's any program, yes.
And further, Agne-Rich could have approved a certificate application without the intervention of the HR administrator, right?
That's possible.
Let's talk about the timing of certificates. Now, there is a date that appears in certificates, correct?
There is a date in the certificate that says when it is, in fact, it can be used, can start to be used, and there is a date that says when it can no longer be used.
And is there not a date that says it was issued at such and such a time and date, correct?
Yes, there may be, yes.
And in the case of the Big Cert certificates that were issued for the law firm, there is a secure time stamping service with a trusted source of time to say when that certificate was issued, correct?
Yes.
And the Rich LLC certificate server is not hooked up to a trusted source of time, correct?
No, it's not.
And there's no time stamping service other than the system clock that would say when a certificate was issued, correct?
That's correct.
The certificate that you used to verify the second trust amendment was issued, the date appears in that certificate as December 24th, 2005, correct?
Well, that's correct.
And the date that's on the second trust amendment is 1 week later, December 31st, 2005, right?
That's correct.
Let's talk about the CA site protection. We talked about Big Sur's data center. It has a device that protects the Big Sur keys that are used to sign the certificates issued to law firm clients, right?
That's correct.
And that device is called a crypto module, correct?
Yes, it is.
Does the Rich LLC certification authority system have a crypto module that holds the keys for the Rich LLC certification authority?
It has a software crypto module.
But it doesn't have a hardware crypto module, correct?
That's correct.
And at the Big Sur facility, the Big Sur personnel, any one person cannot gain access to the machines that issue certificates, right?
To my knowledge, correct.
And it's certainly true, is it not, that anybody from the law firm could not walk into the Big Sur data center and gain access to those machines, right?
That is correct.
Now let's contrast this with the case of Rich LLC. It's true, is it not, that anyone who's got a key could open the door to the room where the certificate server resides, correct?
Yes.
And it's true, is it not, that Ms. Agnew Rich has such a key, right?
That's correct.
And she is, in fact, a person who could have logged on to the server that rests in that room, right?
That's possible.
Let's talk now about the workstation on which signatures were signed. As far as the workstation at the law firm, the keys that were used to sign the first trust amendment were generated on a token, right?
Yes.
And the workstation is at the law firm's office under the law firm's control, correct?
That's correct.
And the personnel of the law firm oversee and make sure that no one has unauthorized access to that workstation, right?
That's correct.
Now let's talk about certificates issued to Rich LLC employees. Those certificates would be issued to desktops or laptops of Rich LLC employees, right?
Yes.
And the private keys of those employees would be on the hard drive of those desktops or laptops, correct?
Stored in protective fashion, yes.
But on a hard drive and not in a token, correct?
That's correct.
And it's true, is it not, that the subscriber can choose whether or not a password is used to protect the private key on the subscriber's machine, right?
Yes.
And it's true, is it not, sir, that there was no password on Rich's workstation used to operate the private key?
None that I saw.
Let's talk about the policy concerning password usage. You didn't see any policy.
Your Honor, in the interest of time, I'm willing to stipulate that there were some differences between these two.
Yes. You have quite a lot of cumulative testimony here, Mr. Wu. How many more bricks do you have to build?
I have three more questions, Your Honor.
All right. Please proceed.
Question number one is, was anything at the Rich LLC certificate server logged other than the issuance of certificates?
No.
And it's true, is it not, that the log files are simply protected by the password on the certificate server itself and nothing else, correct?
That's correct.
And it's true, is it not, that the Rich LLC certification authority had absolutely no regular auditing done on it, correct?
To my knowledge, no.
I have no further questions, Your Honor.
Do you have any further, Mr. Isom?
Sure. Mr. Kesterson, let me talk about just two topics quickly. The first is Mr. Wu has spent some time noting some differences between the First and Second Amendment and the technology relating to that. One of my favorite, it might be the most important, is that one required hardware crypto module and the other a software crypto module, right?
That's correct.
My question about all these differences is, did you see anything in those differences, that is, anything that applied to the Second Amendment that was contrary to what Richie Rich had established by creating the First Amendment and this process?
Even though the implementations may have been slightly different, the mechanisms, the encryption, the keys, those were all the same. The resulting digital signatures are the same algorithms.
And the second topic, Mr. Kesterson, is to emphasize the difference between fact and speculation. You investigated this case thoroughly, I take it.
Yes, sir.
Did you find any fact that suggested that somebody other than Richie Rich had digitally signed the Second Amendment?
I saw no indication that anyone other than Richie Rich signed it.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Wu?
Yes, one simple question. But there are no audit logs that would have shown or would have detected any such effort, were there?
That's correct. I can only go by the digital signature. It's Mr. Rich's digital signature.
Thank you. No other questions, Your Honor.
I've been asked to rule on Mr. Wu's motion on behalf of Mr. Riley that the Second Amendment document digitally signed be excluded from evidence. I'd like to make it clear that there are really two issues involved here with different burdens of proof. The issue we're talking about is whether or not the document may be admitted into evidence to be heard by the fact finder. Now, in this trial, I am the fact finder because I'm a judge sitting without a jury, so the two functions are a little bit conflated and confused, but they are important. If I rule on the on admission of the document into evidence, then it can be used by the finder of fact to weigh its weight and some of the weight of all the other testimony, and then after deciding who has the burden of persuasion, which I am going to rule is the burden of persuasion is on the person producing the document, it will have to be by a preponderance of the evidence. But at this stage, I'm going to reserve not deciding the preponderance of the evidence as to who signed the document, which has some other pieces of evidence in addition to the document. But I am going to admit the document into evidence because it is supported by many of you folks, lawyers visiting from other jurisdictions, are perhaps familiar with the way you authenticate and lay a foundation for evidence under Federal Rule 501A. California has an equivalent of that, which I'll mention in my opinion later. But there's a specific example under federal rule, not specifically under the California rule, that allows evidence of a process which is designed to make a result accurate. That's 501A9. Is that
901 is
a way to show a foundation. So we have here some evidence as foundation for that evidence. So on that basis, I'm allowing it into evidence. But we have not ruled on the weight of it at this point.
At this point, we're going to take another break and have a cut scene. This would end Mr. Isom's presentation of Agnew Rich's case in chief. I would have my own case in chief. I would call Riley Rich to talk about how Rich LLC was run, how Agnew Rich was the head of IT and had super user privileges and so forth. Riley Rich would also testify about what he knows about the trust and the amendments, but he would have absolutely no knowledge about how these documents were signed. I would also call an expert on behalf of Mr. Rich to show that the signature on the second trust amendment was unreliable based on the business processes that we talked about in the cross-examination. I would then rest Mr. Rich's case.
Thank you. Mrs. Rogers, now it's time for the intervener to be heard as to what relief you want. And let me make it clear that I have not decided myself, and we don't know which of these parties will end up with the evidence that is on deposit in your depository, Steel Summit. Why don't you explain to me your concerns and why you're here today?
Yes, Your Honor. Steel Summit provides a very secure way for individual clients to store their very needed protection, okay? Their very valuable information. And we are very concerned that the right of ownership is clearly established by the court before we are ordered to release any of that. We are under obligation by many statutes and regulations to protect the privacy and the contents of our customers. Under our contractual obligations, which, by the way, were with Mr. Richie Rich and Mrs. Farley Rich, we had an established requirement and an agreement that the owners and clients of the data would have the responsibility to protect their data. We provide a mechanism that is very secure, the token device that is unlocked by a password known only to the recipient of the token, allows them to protect their information and their access that's inside of our digital vault. And if you think of this as a lockbox or a safe deposit box, we provide that to our customers. Now, the other thing that we'd like to say is that in delivering the evidence or whatever property is inside that vault, we have a regular process, a predefined transfer of ownership process that we would ask the court to allow us to follow. If you should rule on who is the correct owner, we would like the Steele Summit's process to be followed in the correct transfer of ownership and access to that property. The other thing that I must tell the court is there are two pieces of information that have not been brought out in this case, one of which is that the access to this digital vault is provided by the access token and the password.
Is that the one we understand has a golf bag attached to it?
Yes, Your Honor, I understand that now. I did not realize. That particular token is the key to the front door of the digital vault. But it also allows the client or the customer who puts valuable property in the vault to optionally encrypt the data that or the information that's inside the vault. Now, in doing that encryption, that customer can decide to have it encrypted only with their own very own token, or in this case, it was probably with the two tokens for Mr. Rich and also Mrs. Farley Rich. But they have an optional service that we provide that says, as a last resort recovery mechanism, they can decide to encrypt with an additional decryption key that Steele Summit will hold. The process that we use is a great technology. It splits the other arbitrary decryption key so that two factors of that key are separately stored within Steele Summit. It's like a key escrow. No one ever touches that. The process is automated, and it takes a regular process of taking two different authorities to be able to put that key together and recover the data. But I must tell you that if the client has not chosen that option and has not included the additional decryption key, that the contents of this digital vault may in fact be encrypted solely in the key that's sitting in your token, which is now in the golf bag token.
So we might not know after there's a decision as to who owns it, they open up the box, we might not know whether they need further encryption help, decryption help.
If they have access to the token, which is in the golf bag, and the password, they will be able to decrypt whatever is inside the vault. But my point here, Your Honor, is that Steele Summit does not wish to be put in the position of trying to decrypt contents of a customer's vault. We have no authority without the customer's expressed commission or permission to do that, and without them choosing to use the last resort recovery key.
I see. You have no objection, however, to my deciding who owns the property as the successors to your original clients, and if they come in, she, whoever it is that has that right, comes in under the procedure that is adopted in the agreement when the box was opened, then you're going to follow that, and you have no objection to that. You're asking me not to ask you at this time to vary that process. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
I thank you very much. I think I understand that. Do we have any position from either of the opponents in the other issues on what we just heard from Mrs. Rogers and Steele Summit's position? Does Agnew Rich have any objection?
No, Your Honor. I think that so long as you retain jurisdiction over this property, once we know the ruling, if there are any details, we'd like to be heard, but we have no objection.
Well, would you have any objection if the decryption key, let's say your client won the main ruling, but the decryption key went to Mr. Riley Rich because of the golf bag which is attached to it? Is that a problem for you?
Let me address that directly then, Your Honor. Your Honor, the facts in this case are that Riley Rich himself put the token in a golf bag knickknack. The fact that he attached it to that kind of knickknack is
well. Without deciding whether or not he gets the token, mm-hmm. Is it a problem if a different person who owns it has the token to decrypt the information?
Well, we would want Your Honor, to order him to supply that token to give access.
Mr. Wu.
Your Honor, I agree with Mr. Isom that this court has jurisdiction to say where the property in Steele Summit's repository goes. So we agree with that. I agree with Mr. Isom on that, but I disagree, however, in the sense that my client is entitled to the golf bag. The trust amendment, and the alleged second trust amendment all say that Mr. Riley Rich is entitled to all the golf-related paraphernalia. Mr. Richie Rich put the USB token in a golf bag, knick-knack, without clearly my client is entitled to that golf bag USB token.
I believe that concludes the testimony, and we are now going to adjourn this court to have any new people that want to come into part two come in, and also anyone who's had enough after part one can leave. But you will not know how this comes out if you leave now. However, let's have a little straw vote. Will you stand up, Mr. Eisen, and will you stand up, Mr. Wu? Let's just hear a straw vote on who's in favor of Agnew, who wants to admit amendment number two, electronic. Who thinks that's going to be the winner? How many? Raise your hand. Not too many. How many think that it's going to be thrown out, amendment number two? Tune in next session to find out. Thank you.